We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
America is at a crossroads.
We're talking about November 5th. The consequences of this election are broader than even sometimes I grasp.
You only have two options, to vote or not vote.
AFA at Home takes a deep look.
Pray for fair elections, that God's hand is over these elections.
It all impacts you directly. Make your voice heard.
Don't miss this special edition of AFA at Home on AFA Stream. Visit stream.afa.net to sign up today. Stream.afa.net.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Well, it is Wednesday, October 23rd, so we are under 2 weeks away from the November 5th election. And, you know, the polls have been, you know, really all over the place. And everyone is saying, according to the polls, that it is a razor thin margin. But then if you look at both of the camps, Kamala Harris's side says there's absolutely no way that Trump is that far ahead. And Trump's side is saying there's absolutely no way that Kamala Harris is that far ahead. And so the polls are always an interesting sort of talking point issue. I personally don't put a ton of stock in the polls. I mean, we've seen from the last two elections how far off a lot of that was. I mean, even some of the internal polling from various sources and the campaigns themselves. And a lot of times polls are kind of these self-fulfilling prophecies where people are just are trying to say, well, according to this poll, my candidate is so far ahead, regardless of what race it is. That includes a presidential race as well. And so can we really rely on that? A much more interesting indication, I think, is that early voting has already started across the country and in some of the significant swing states that I think is going to ultimately determine the Electoral College count. That includes Nevada, North Carolina, Arizona, a few others. And we do know from some states what at least the political affiliation is of some of those early voters. And so according to a CNN article and the other reports, about 18 million and counting early votes have already been cast. And so that represents about 10% overall of the total voters that voted in the last election. So what does that tell us? Well, I think that a lot of it comes down as well to the fact that Republicans are actually taking advantage of mail-in ballots and going to the polls early. And Trump's rhetoric on this and the whole GOP messaging on this has vastly changed from 2020. Here's what Trump recently said about going and early voting. This is cut two.
So if you have a ballot, return it immediately. If not, go tomorrow as soon as you can. Go to the polls and vote. Then for the next 21 days, get everyone you know to get out and vote.
Well, let's welcome in Chris Lane, who is the director at Signal Media. So, Chris, what do you make of the early voting stats?
Yeah, I'm seeing a lot of what you're seeing, and Republicans have definitely closed the gap on this early voting. Now, the real question here, though, is are Republican voters just coming out earlier, which will make their election day advantage smaller than it has historically been? Or are these new voters and Republicans are going to be able to run up the score because the traditional early vote versus election day vote will be approximately the same? That's the real question that won't be answered until election day.
Yeah, and so it's interesting to see how, you know, some of these stats, when we're looking particularly at swing states like Pennsylvania, for example. I was listening to a report this morning that was saying that, you know, something like over 60% are Democrats that have early voted in terms of political affiliation so far. So clearly Kamala Harris has, you know, a wide lead in Pennsylvania. Which I think is accurate, just in terms of the breakdown of Pennsylvania and the early voting stats. But at the same time, this election is so different in terms of just the base and how, you know, we saw Tulsi Gabbard, who was a former Democrat, actually switch parties and join the Republican Party last night. We've seen RFK leave the Democrat Party. And we've also seen a lot of, you know, never again Trump kind of rhetoric from some of the registered Republican base who is either voting for Kamala or just leaving the top of the ticket blank. So how much do we actually know about these votes that are cast when we're just looking at the political affiliation in early voting?
Yeah, those are really good questions. Let me start with the second half of your question about, you know, those quote unquote never Trumpers. And of course there are those people, but those people were never Trumpers in 2016. Those people were never Trumpers in 2020. No one has voted for Donald Trump in the past and now has decided not to at this point, or I shouldn't say no one, very, very few. The phenomenon we are seeing time and time again, over hundreds and hundreds of polls in competitive districts across the country, is 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, even 9% of 2020 Biden voters voting for Donald Trump, the large majority of which have never voted for Donald Trump before. They don't like Donald Trump. They have an unfavorable on Donald Trump, but they also feel like they have no choice but to push back on the system in some way. And so we're actually seeing more people voting for Donald Trump for the very first time than people abandoning Trump after voting for him in 16 and 20.
And I'm speaking with Chris Lane, who is the director of Signal Media. And, you know, Chris, all of this is really fascinating. And I think that the early voting is at least a better indication than some of the polls because, you know, you can't really manipulate that in terms of, OK, here are the demographics of the political affiliation of early voter turnout compared to how, you know, polls can tend to favor one side or the other, depending on the questions asked and some of those things. So what about the new registered voters? Because there's been a huge push from the GOP this election cycle to register new voters, especially in the swing states. We've seen Elon Musk having, you know, his America PAC that is really encouraging people in those swing states to register voters. Have we seen that yet reflected in the Republican early voting turnout?
We have, and we have also noticed the percentage of what we call 0 out of 4 voters, meaning folks who have never voted in 1, 2, 3, or 4 of the last 4 general elections, are making up a larger percentage of the early vote than they typically do. The other thing I would say is Democrats have had such huge advantages in early voting for many cycles in a row now. Yes, they still have that advantage, but the gap is much smaller. And I think that's the most important takeaway here, is that Trump truly has changed his rhetoric on this, and the priorities of Republicans around registering voters and getting them out to vote early because they know the benefits of that. Trump has changed tactics, and frankly, it's the best thing for us, for Republicans, because otherwise, you know, you were discouraging a huge block of voters from getting out and voting. And, you know, very often those people who had intentions of voting on Election Day sometimes don't. And now we're widening that window for them to have the opportunity to do so.
Yeah, I think it's really smart. I mean, and even, you know, back in 2020, and obviously, you know, I was working for the Trump campaign at the time, and that was a little bit different era because it was also during COVID, and you had, you know, some states who hadn't done the mail-in voting thing at all were trying to, you know, get a handle on how to exactly to do that in the midst of COVID. You had, you know, some other very unprecedented issues with the voting turnout, even early voting. And so, you know, I think this is smart to go that direction. How will this change some of the reporting on the results potentially on election night when we're seeing that Republicans are making up for that gap? And so it's not going to be heading into Election Day with sort of this, you know, wide, far lead for Democrats.
Yeah. And I'd go back to what I previously said. Yes, that gap is much smaller. And so, but that also means most likely from a data perspective, the big advantage on election day itself for Republicans will probably be slightly diminished than what we typically see. So what happened in 2020 with, you know, Trump having big leads in swing states and having them, quote unquote, disappear overnight is probably going to be less of a phenomenon this time around just because of when people are actually voting. And then as far as, you know, younger voters, to your previous question, a study came out recently that 12th grade boys are more conservative than they ever have been in the last 50 years, and 12th grade girls are more liberal than they have been in 50 years. And so we are seeing a movement for younger people towards the Republican Party, but it's almost exclusively males. And the other thing I can tell you from our national surveys month after month after month, for the better part of a half decade now, is the gap between men and women generally just continues to grow. The gap between college-educated and non-college-educated continues to grow. So we're actually seeing more divides along gender and education level than we do geography at this point. So that's going to be an interesting trend to continue to watch. And then obviously we've seen Donald Trump reverse a bunch of trends, particularly with African-American voters, Latino voters, and, you know, does that translate to the ballot box? And I think the biggest misconception about 2020 was that, you know, Donald Trump lost by this wide margin in the Electoral College. But in reality, you know, he lost a few states by hundreds or thousands of votes. That was the difference. And, you know, based on everything we're seeing, I think there's, you know, enough movement here to really change the outcome of this election.
And that's really fascinating. And, you know, and it was the same thing for Hillary Clinton in 2016. I mean, while it was a landslide in the Electoral College math, the districts that she lost by a pretty thin margin just ended up adding up to the Electoral College math, which is, you know, kind of where Governor Tim Walz is going with saying, you know, let's get rid of the Electoral College and just do a national popular vote, which, you know, I covered extensively for listeners on my podcast last week. So you can find that at AFR.net. Click our icon for podcasts. And, you know, that's for many reasons isn't a great option. And we should be very careful about not changing our processes. But Chris Ling, going back to, you know, what you said about some of these other demographics that are really important, including, you know, the differences and widening gaps that we're seeing based on gender. Do we know any of those kind of demographics from early voters, not just their political affiliation?
What we do know is 79% of early voters have been female. There is going to be a huge swing from that perspective, too, as far as who's actually voting now versus who's going to vote on election day. Men have indicated all year long they're much more likely to vote on election day than they are early, and that's exactly what the early numbers are showing us. We're also seeing wealthier voters during early voting and mail-in voting than we've ever seen before. I think that can be attributed to the fact that Republicans are embracing early and mail-in voting because, frankly, they needed to. But that's the other huge split to monitor here is wealthier, older, particularly women, flooding the ballot box early in a way that they never have before.
So you're saying that men are procrastinators. That's what I'm getting from that. So, I mean, that tracks with everything that I know.
I was going to say that, but, you know, I would leave you to draw your own conclusions on that.
Fair enough. But, yeah, but it's interesting. And even, you know, friends of mine and relatives, you know, I even had my cousin texted me yesterday and said, okay, I've early voted. And so I'm checking out from the last 2 weeks of all of this ridiculous drama. I don't need to pay attention anymore. And I think that's also interesting because I just saw this morning, like right before, we got on the radio, Mark Halperin, who is the journalist who actually predicted Biden withdrawing from the race, said on a media interview yesterday that he has been pitched a story that apparently he's vetting, that he's saying, you know, if true, could end Trump's campaign. I'm sitting here thinking, okay, you know, what could possibly be that damaging as an October surprise at this point? But also the fact that so many millions of voters are early voting, even if something comes out in, say, the next week, not only would that probably not have that much of an impact this close to the race, but also, you know, you can't change your vote once you've early voted. And so is that potentially part of the strategy from the GOP as well to just say, you know, listen, we've got to get the votes basically locked in?
first, and I don't know the specific state-by-state rules, but in some states you actually can change your vote with an earlier mail-in ballot. So that would be interesting. But to your overall point, I think a larger percentage of the vote has been casted at this point than any other election in our history. But the other thing I'm really following and find interesting is we have believed all year long that the turnout in 2024 would not match the turnout in 2020. Just from what was going on in the world at that point, the pushback, you know, by so many, particularly in the media, towards Donald Trump, and that this election was less about persuasion, but just an ability to turn out your own voters again. And that's where I think Donald Trump ultimately has the advantage.
Yeah, well, Chris Lane, really appreciate your comments. He's the director at Signal Media, and we'll be talking more about early voting and what we can expect now under 2 weeks from the 2024 election. We come right back here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And we are under 2 weeks from the 2024 presidential election. And what about the evangelical turnout? Because there is a study from Barna that is saying that about 35 million self-identified Christians are not going to turn out for the 2024 election. And that would be a travesty, in my opinion, of course, because Christians need to get out and vote our values. So let's welcome in John Amanchukwu, my next guest, who is a pastor from the swing state of North Carolina. And John, you know, it's really, frankly, discouraging to hear a stat like that. And I hope that that ends up not being the case in the 2024 election. But what are you seeing overall? Because I know that you travel across the country and are connected with a wide network of pastors to see how churches are trying to fill in that gap and urge their congregations to get out and vote.
Yeah, some churches are doing a good job with it, you know. They're making sure that they keep the main thing the main thing, and they're reminding their congregations to vote biblical values. But then you always have your woke, liberal, leftist-leaning churches that pretty much say nothing about these issues because they don't want to have dirty hands. They don't want to offend anyone. They don't want to address cultural issues, so they sit in the seat of neutrality. And they think that we should only focus on what's going on in the four walls of the church, and they're grossly wrong. But Jenna, I would tell you this, the greatest issue that we're contending with right now in the Christian church is the lack of having a biblical worldview amongst pastors. You know, George Barna did a study in 2004 to find out the biblical worldview for pastors, and at that time frame, it was about 51%. But in 2022, that same study was done, and it had dropped down to a measly 37%. And now amongst youth pastors in particular, their biblical worldview is around 12 to 13%. So what's happening? The church is becoming more postmodern. You know, we're seeker-friendly. And more so, we've fallen into the trap of syncretism, where we are beginning to bring in cultural thoughts and ideologies, and even sometimes Marxist ideologies, and mix that with our biblical worldview, which perverts our biblical worldview and keeps us from focusing on the things that are prominent and that are most important in this season.
You know, I think that's an excellent correlation between the impact of the church and the biblical worldview, because if a church is not teaching a biblical worldview, then we can't expect it to be effective in changing culture or even engaging in things like living the Christian life in civil society. And that stat from Barna, you know, is also unfortunately discouraging in a way, because we're seeing, you know, some of those things go way down. But You know, our share-a-thon here at AFR, which was a couple of weeks ago, the theme was, you know, revive us again, O Lord, and that psalm. And I think that was so well put because I'm speaking to John Amanchukwu, who's a pastor out of North Carolina. And John, I think that that really needs to be a prayer for this country heading into the next 2 weeks, because this isn't just about voting. Obviously, we need to get out and vote. We need to do all of the things, but we can't forget to pray for God's blessing and even withholding of judgment on the United States.
Yes, I agree with that. You know, I believe that we have the power at the ballot box to speed up the spread of evil or to slow it down. And so your vote, hear me when I say this, listeners, your vote has influence. It has power. And now more than ever, we can't sit in the seat of neutrality and say, oh, yeah, I just have one vote and it's not going to count. And what do I have to offer? No, your vote will count. We're going to believe that election integrity will be supreme this upcoming election. We're going to trust God to do his part, but we're going to do our part. And, you know, Dietrich Bonhoeffer once said, to fail to act is to act, and to fail to speak is to speak. Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. once said that there comes a time when silence becomes betrayal. And we know what Ezekiel says. Ezekiel says if we fail to say what God has called us to say, then blood will be upon the hands of the watchman. And so we have a role. You know, and I think that this is the finest hour for the church. You know, things are much darker than they've ever been, but the light shines the brightest in the darkness. And so it's time for us to grab the bull by the horns. Yes, we need to pray, call upon heaven to come to our defense and be our, and God for God to be our advocate. But we need to act. Action is important in this season. We need to act, we need to vote, and to vote biblical values.
Preach it, brother. I could not agree more. And we absolutely need to act, and we need to stand up for truth. And this isn't just about, you know, once every couple of years in the ballot box. This is about exposing evil, rooting out evil, and combating that with good. And you are doing such a phenomenal job of doing that in other elections that matter, like school board, for example. And you just recently released a brand new documentary that is called 22 Words, Exposing the Loss of Decency in American Education. You can go to 22wordsfilm.com, 22wordsfilm.com, and talk about why you made this film at this moment.
Well, you know, when we look at the current landscape of the American education system, we can sense and tell that something is broken, something is missing. And when we go back and take a look at the court cases that led up to the removal of school-sponsored prayer and school-directed Bible reading, we can point to some incidents that took place in our past that has created this degradation that we see today. When you consider the Engle v. Vitale case in 1962, the Murray v. Curlett case in 1963, and the Abington School District v. Shimp case in 1963, we see clearly that these court cases put the American education on a slip, the American education system on a slippery slope. And so the title of my documentary is 22 Words, and it comes from the school-sponsored prayer that was banned in 1962. It says, Almighty God, we acknowledge our dependence upon thee, and we beg thy blessings upon us, our parents, our teachers, and our country. Jenna, that was a non-denominational, non-proselytizing prayer. It didn't invoke the name of Allah, of Buddha, or even Reverend Sun Yat-moon. It didn't even mention the name of Jesus. Now, we know that it was a Christian prayer because we know who Almighty God is, and we don't shrink back from saying that America was founded upon Judeo-Christian principles. We believe that. But, you know, former Secretary of Education William Bennett revealed in his culture indexes that between 1960 and 1990, divorce doubled, teenage pregnancy went up 200%. Teen suicide increased 300%, and violent crime went up by 500%. A factual case can be made that the expulsion of prayer in schools led to the decline of American society.
Wow, that is just a sad trend. And I remember reading, you know, some of Bill Bennett's books growing up, and you know, it's sad to see the focus on education then and where we're at today. But this is why, you know, things like school choice matters. Good things. I talked yesterday about Amendment 80 in Colorado and why, you know, that's not clearly for school choice. It's actually allowing, you know, the vagaries of some of the textual language to allow for the government to define what a quality education would be and have a so-called right of a child to have a quality education. Well, what does that mean? And so we have to be careful how we go about trying to rein in some of these trends. Where do you see the culture going by and large with so much emphasis now, especially over the last, you know, couple of years since all of the school board stuff in Virginia and when Governor Glenn Youngkin was elected, I think primarily for that reason, because of so much attention drawn to this issue. Are we making a difference, and what work still needs to be done?
Well, work still needs to be done across the board. We need to gut woke indoctrination across the board, from our preschools to our grade schools, all the way through our college and universities, and even in many of our Fortune 500 and Fortune 100 companies. We need to remove the woke indoctrination, the emphasis upon the false triune idol of diversity, equity, and inclusion, which I call the ultimate black face. On face value, DEI purports that it defends and protects the upward mobility of minorities, but that's not the case. Behind DEI is a group of white liberals, and I say that respectfully. It's a group of white liberals who are pushing an agenda to trans America. It's about trans zealots. They had to find a creative way to hitch their movement to something else, so they chose the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And so they're now equating one's predisposition to desire the same sex or to change their sex to the plight of minorities, blacks in America, i.e. slavery and Jim Crow. But here's the thing, Jenna, I didn't choose to be a black man, nor did you choose to be a white woman. But people choose to be trans. You choose your sexual persuasion. And so these things across the board are driving the American education system downward, because the focus is not on reading, writing, and arithmetic. It's on talking about a kid's pronouns, or what is your color, or what is your flag. You know, when I went to school, the only flag we talked about was the American flag and the state flag. Today, there are 50-plus flags out there that represent one's Kama Sutra or desire to have sex. And that is not educational or beneficial for children. It's rather demonic.
Yeah, so well said. I'm speaking with Pastor John Amanchukwu, who released this great new documentary that you really need to see, 22 Words, Exposing the Loss of Decency in American Education. You can go to 22wordsfilm.com. That's 22 words, plural, film.com. And, you know, this really emphasizes with this whole trans movement and really just telling kids and confusing them about their own identity in how God made them. I mean, it's no wonder that when we're talking about things like abortion being on the ballot and so many other things, you know, whether it's also mental health issues that are on the rise, especially in younger people and teens. All of this comes back to what you said in the very beginning, John Amanchukwu, about a biblical worldview. And, you know, there are people like our friend Ryan Walters in Oklahoma that simply just want to bring the Bible back to schools as a history book, as a textbook. And that is so important. We have to bring the biblical worldview back to public life, to civics, and especially to churches as well, first and foremost. So what's your encouragement to to pastors and then also to parents in terms of actually standing for truth and not being afraid of the just sheer evil that we see in our culture today?
Well, I'll say this, Jenna, and I can speak from experience. You know, I was recently handcuffed for making a stand for children in Wake County. We call it Woke County, but it's really Wake County. I was handcuffed for doing that. And I just recently received in the mail that they have barred me from that school board meeting, and I cannot come back.
Wow.
I can't go back to the school board meeting. And so I just received that last night, and I read through it, and I'm considering all forms of legal action against them because they're banning me because of a peaceful protest where I called them out for failing to adhere to state law. I'm not the criminal. They are. But I've now been to 15 states. I can speak to this personally. I've been to Virginia, North Carolina, New Jersey, Nevada, Florida, Texas, Colorado, California, Idaho, Pennsylvania, Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana, Missouri, and Maryland. And there are three takeaways that I have as a result of speaking out at these school board meetings nationally. Number one, perverts are perverting the hearts and the minds of our children. Number two, parents are grossly unaware. And number three, pastors have failed to do their job. And so let me speak to the parents first. It's not your job to drop your kid off at school and to expect for the current education system of where you drop them off at, be it public or private. It's not up for you to expect for them to solely do what is right. You have to inspect what you expect. You need to know the curriculum. Know who's teaching your child, not just for first period, second period. You need to know who their PE teacher is. Know who's in the cafeteria. Know who the guidance counselor is. Know the books that are on the bookshelves. Know the supplementary materials that your kids are being that they're using. You know, oftentimes these things sneak in through supplemental materials. And these individuals who have these leftist-leaning viewpoints, they find creative ways to have our children do surveys in class to show them that they are, quote-unquote, privileged if they're white, or that they're a victim if they're black. These things are intentional. And so, parents, you are the first and primary pedagogues. God called for you to catechize your child. Train up a child in the way that he should go, and when he's old, he will not depart. That extends to, yes, to home, but also to the classroom. Make sure that the classroom works in synergy with what the home life is expected to be, and then what the church life is expected to be. And so, yes, parents, you have a role to do. And then pastors, now more than ever, I'm going to give you a cutting edge plan to grow your church. You know, everyone wants to talk about being cutting edge today and, you know, being ahead of the digital divide and, you know, all of these things. I'll give you something that's cutting edge. You know, the Bible tells us to preach the word. That's as cutting edge as it gets.
John Amanchukwu could not have said it better. Go to 22wordsfilm.com. We'll be right back with more right after this. Could the fate of America's children be tied to the fate of our nation itself? Much like the abortionists who end the lives of the unborn, the left is determined to undermine the pro-life movement. First, they target the babies. Then they come for the rest of us. Preborn stands as a beacon of hope for the most defenseless among us, preborn babies. Every day, Preborn's network of clinics rescue, on average, over 200 babies while surrounding expectant mothers with God's love and offering a free ultrasound. Rescuing the miracle of life has never been more crucial as we navigate this time of moral decline in our nation. Will you join Preborn in protecting the least among us? For just $28, you can sponsor an ultrasound and give a mother the chance to choose life, not only for her baby, but for herself. An ultrasound doubles a baby's chance at life. To donate securely, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com/AFR. Preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, we're still not past all of the October surprises in terms of just the ridiculous, surprising rhetoric. And as of yesterday at a campaign stop, President Biden, yeah, he still is the president, by the way. I mean, I think a lot of us just kind of ignore that fact, and the Democrats have certainly forgotten about it. But President Biden announced at a campaign stop in New Hampshire yesterday that former President Trump should be locked up and thrown in jail. Listen to this. This cut one.
Bizarre. It sounds like I said this 5 years ago. You'd lock me up. We got to lock him up. Politically lock him up.
Well, let's welcome in our good friend Chris Woodward, who is a reporter for American Family News. And Chris, you know, talking about a threat to democracy, I mean, Biden didn't even articulate why he thinks that. It's just, this is political opposition, lock him up. And that seems like, honestly, from a lot of the rhetoric on both sides, it's just, you know, use the system in any way to go after our political opponents. And that's not something that our process supports.
Yeah, good morning. This shows, I think, that President Joe Biden, our president, is full of malarkey when he says that we need to tone down the rhetoric and stop saying things like this. It's the same president, our president, who has said things like Donald Trump is going to use the government to go after his political enemies. Who's in charge of the government right now? It's Joe Biden, and he's saying we need to, quote, lock up Donald Trump.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. And we've seen all of the lawfare going after political opponents, not just Donald Trump, but, you know, a lot of the pro-life advocates, a lot of the Catholics and Christians. I mean, we have seen this Justice Department under Biden-Harris be weaponized to go after viewpoints. I mean, all of the Twitter files that have come out and the pressure for censorship. I mean, these are genuinely concerning issues for a country that is built on the legitimacy of government protecting our God-given rights instead of having government privileges when, where, and how they determine that we can exercise them and what constitutes misinformation or what constitutes, you know, what we can go after. And so, you know, this comment made headlines yesterday. Do you really think that a lot of the, at least the Democrat base, are even paying attention to Joe Biden right now, or is this kind of not really going to make that much of a splash?
I don't think a lot of Democrats are paying attention to him. They've kind of written him off. I think sometimes he says, or sometimes I wonder, speculate whether or not he says or does things just to remind people that he's currently in office as president, just to remind people that he's still there. But by and large, a lot of people are focused on Kamala Harris. That's understandable. She's trying to win. We're 2 weeks out from the election. It's looking like Donald Trump is going to beat her, although there's still a lot of time left for a campaign to derail and another to rise to the occasion. So I think a lot of Democrats are not paying attention to it, but a lot of people on the right are understandably upset by what Joe Biden said yesterday. And, you know, it's not the first time. He said a lot of things very similar to that. For example, Todd Starnes yesterday had an article where he dug up a similar comment from Biden back in 2022. So this comment is going to make headlines, and understandably so, but it's not the first time that he's ever said something like this in the office as president.
Yeah, and that comment, and this is coming from Todd Starnes' piece at toddstarnes.com, who's a good friend of the show. We have him on as much as we can. He reports this during a November 9th, 2022 press conference. Biden, when asked about the prospects of Trump running against him in 2024, said, quote, "We just have to demonstrate that he will not take power. If he does run, making sure he, under legitimate efforts of our Constitution, does not become the next president again." And that kind of rhetoric, Chris Woodward, is very similar to what we saw from Jamie Raskin and a few other Democrats that are suggesting that even if Trump wins the election, they are going to try to use what they say are, you know, legitimate efforts of the Constitution, but basically trying to use the process to prevent that. So, you know, everybody's hoping that kind of we're done with this election in the next, you know, under 2 weeks now. But how, depending on who wins, are we going to see some of these challenges from House members or legal challenges or, you know, things like that? What's your prediction?
Yeah, I do think we're going to see challenges. Somehow, some way, they're going to claim that this vice president has the ability to question or challenge election results. I wouldn't be shocked if that happens. We know the media is, like, on their side, and they'll probably do a lot of coverage of that to try to bring on so-called experts to explain away or justify why it is what they're trying to do.
Yeah. And, you know, it's very interesting, as always, that everything goes for the Democrats and they can do literally whatever they want. And then if it comes down to Republicans, well, you know, you're undermining democracy if you even try to take advantage of a process. So we see the hypocrisy on full display. And there was even hypocrisy that you've done a lot of reporting on, Chris Woodward, over at American Family News, that Democrats are being hypocritical, claiming the Trump appearance at McDonald's was staged. I saw that trend on X, and I just had to laugh because I'm like, everything that Kamala Harris has done has been staged. I mean, she can't even go to a town hall without a teleprompter. So, you know, this is yet again another projection from the Democrats instead of actually reaching the merits, perhaps, of their candidate beyond vibes and joy.
Right. You can't spell Kamala Harris without S-T-A-G-E-D. And I say that because from the moment where she supposedly called Joe Biden to say, "We did it, Joe," there just happened to be a camera there. When she called state and local officials to talk about storm response after claiming Ron DeSantis wouldn't take her call or call her about it, there just happened to be cameras there rolling on both her and the person that she was talking to. Everything she has done as vice president-elect through now has been staged to some extent. We even had an example this week where at the town hall with Representative Liz Cheney, Maria Shriver got a question from somebody in the audience saying, "Hey, can I ask Kamala Harris a question?" And Maria Shriver, who prides herself as being a, quote, open-minded journalist, went on to say, "I'm sorry, but our questions are predetermined. It is all staged."
Yeah, and imagine if that had happened at a Trump town hall, that would be nonstop playing on legacy media and all of the influencers on social media 24/7. But that just kind of goes by the wayside when it's Kamala Harris. It's like, oh yeah, of course, you know, she can do whatever she wants, and we have to make sure to, you know, not make Kamala even the least bit uncomfortable. So, you know, all of these things, I think ultimately do have some cumulative impact, at least in terms of maybe some of the moderate and swing voters. But it's going to be, you know, really interesting, I think, to see how many people early vote, as we were talking about earlier in the program, and then ultimately, you know, where those swing states come down to. But I want to change topics here. Chris Woodward, who's my guest this morning, reporter for American Family News. There was a press release that just came out this month that Do No Harm is launching the first national database exposing the child trans industry. And some of these statistics are just incredibly, frankly, horrifying because, you know, the left, again, being hypocritical, is saying, oh, this never happens. And there's, you know, no none of these surgeries, you know, ever happen. But, you know, what have you seen from this database in terms of their key findings?
Yeah, well, first of all, Do No Harm and this Stop the Harm database, that basically they dug up a lot of insurance claims and other things to show which hospitals across these United States of America, red states and blue states and purple states, all kinds of hospitals, all kinds of doctors, filing insurance claims and Medicare, Medicaid things for puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, even doing surgeries and stuff like that for minors. This is a very important story, and really Do No Harm kind of already did the homework for reporters that should be covering this story. They put out this information. It comes at a time when people are saying it's not happened, but this group says, oh, yes, it is, and here's where it's happening. It's Do No Harm's already done the work. And they put out this database, and it really does show that this stuff is happening despite what Democrats and other people are claiming. And we do know it's happening in red states, like I said. Even Ken Paxton, the attorney general of Texas, is suing a doctor for doing this kind of thing. We also had another doctor in Texas that has been blowing the whistle on his big hospital system employer doing this kind of thing. It is happening. I talked to Pennsylvania Family Institute this week, and they had a big event with legislators in Harrisburg because Philadelphia is one of the places where this is happening a lot.
Wow. And I mean, some of these national or key national findings, and you can find this at donoharmmedicine.org, donoharmmedicine.org, that 13,994, so almost 14,000 children received a sex change related treatment from 2019 to 2023, almost 6,000 sex change surgeries performed on children, a little over 60,000 hormone and puberty blocker prescriptions were written for 8,500 pediatric patients. And this is the key number here, that $119 million was made from sex change treatments performed on minors. I mean, this is a billion-dollar industry where where Big Pharma and others are targeting minors to create an entire industry of patients in the trans cycle. And so this is where I think this is very aptly named, Chris, that it's, you know, first do no harm as part of the Hippocratic Oath. That should be taken more seriously, because none of these things are medically necessary. And of course, they're actually medically harmful.
Yes. And somebody that's saying that is Chloe Cole. She now works with or works for Do No Harm. Chloe Cole is one of the many Americans that thought they were the other, went through various procedures to try to, in their mind, become the other sex, and went on to regret it. She is one of many examples out there. And it's not just young people that are those examples. You have Walt Heyer as well. You may have had him on your program before, but Walt Heyer is somebody that founded an organization called Sex Change Regret. He's probably 65, 70 years old, if he's that old. I saw him speak at this year's Pray Vote Stand in Washington, D.C. He works for FRC. But there are a number of people out there that do say people come on, they go on to regret going through these procedures, from drugs to surgery, stuff like that. So, America, do not let anybody tell you this is for the best, this helps the person. It actually harms the person, which is why you have organizations called Do No Harm trying to bring light to the situation so that way we can all put an end to it.
Yeah, this is just such a tragedy. And, you know, Chris, our churches need to be prepared for these types of regret and outcomes. And, you know, some of the things that I've even listened to testimonies on various outlets from people saying that because of surgeries and other things, their ability to procreate has been taken away from them. They can't have kids. I mean, there are so many different permanent and lasting impacts, and there are also just, you know, trauma and scars from these types of completely medically unnecessary things. And the church really needs to be equipped to handle this from a biblical,
yes,
truthful worldview.
Exactly.
What would you say, to pastors? Because, you know, I have, and of course, everybody who listens knows that my mom is a biblical counselor. You know, my dad is a church administrator at our home church in Colorado. And, you know, I would love to see pastors more equipped to actually deal with this than just farm this out to, you know, the so-called medical professionals who may or may not be coming from a biblical worldview.
Yeah. Well, pastors do need to touch on it. Many of them need to grow a backbone and actually talk about things that people need to hear versus seven bullet points on how you can have a great week.
Right.
So that's one thing. Small groups would probably do well to cover this as well. There's a number of center-right, faith-based apps that cover all kinds of things. Certainly, we have information and materials available at AFA. Our stories about all this stuff can be found on AFN.net. It's interesting you brought that up, because yesterday on AFR's At the Core program, Allie Beth Stuckey, author and conservative podcaster, was on to talk about how the left will often try to touch our heartstrings and talk about things like trans healthcare is healthcare and social justice and love your neighbor and all these things. We should love our neighbor, but telling people the truth and telling people about the Bible is loving your neighbor. And the best way we can learn about the Bible is in our churches and when we're actually in the Bible ourselves, so that way we can effectively communicate what it is that God wants us to share with those people versus, okay, just do whatever you want, and here's some tax dollars to do it.
Yeah, preach it, my man. This is Chris Woodward, who is a reporter at AFN, and obviously AFN comes from a biblical worldview perspective, as does AFR, and it's so true that loving our neighbor is speaking truth in love, but making sure that we are standing up for truth and ensuring that we continue to promote the goodness and the grace of the Lord and the truth of the Lord, which includes telling the truth to everyone in our churches and to stand up firmly. So this is donoharmmedicine.org. And this is the first national database exposing the child trans industry. There's a lot of really good stuff in here. So I'd really encourage listeners to go and use this in conversations to your advantage, because these are all issues. It's not just about, you know, the top of the ticket, Trump versus communism. That's important. The worldview is important. But all of these things that impact our culture, all of this stuff is on the ballot, in whether directly or indirectly, all the way down ticket. So this is why it's so important that Christians make our voices heard. Go out, vote your values. Go early vote if you can. Just make sure that you are getting out and vote. Chris Woodward, always appreciate your time, and you can always reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.